From the heart of our nation's capital, here's Family Research Council President Tony Perkins. Sitting in today for Tony is our own Sarah Perry, Director of Partnerships for Family Research Council.
Welcome to this Thursday edition of Washington Watch. I am Sarah Perry. I am sitting in for Tony Perkins here on this Thursday afternoon. While the Trump administration moved yesterday to expand faith protections for federal contractors, the latest front in the ongoing battle between LGBTQ groups fighting discrimination and employers seeking to operate in accordance with their religious beliefs. In just a minute, I'll talk with Mary Beth Waddle, FRC's senior legislative assistant, about some history behind the proposal and what this means going forward for religious organizations. In my second segment, I'll talk about a compelling op-ed column in USA Today written by a father entitled, "My Daughter Thinks She's Transgender. Her public school undermined my efforts to help her." Joining me with her analysis will be Dr. Michelle Cretilla, president of the American College of Pediatricians. At the bottom of the hour, Lieutenant General Jerry Boykin, Family Research Council's executive vice president and a founding member of the elite Delta Force, will join me. Today is the 7th anniversary of the shooting in our lobby, just a few floors down from where I sit. General Boykin was here that fateful day, and you will learn about both the gunman and a hero on our staff. And in my last block at 42 past the hour, we will learn about a bizarre freshman orientation at Virginia Tech that was full of leftist propaganda. We know because the son of Penny Nance, president of Concerned Women for America, attended it. Stick around for the full scoop and my discussion for Penny. As a reminder, TonyPerkins.com is our podcast website. We encourage you to share the program you listen to today. More resources and guest information can be found on that website. Tony's Twitter handle is at TPerkins, mine at Sarah P. Perry. We encourage you to take a listen to our podcast and follow on social media. Well, the Trump administration has continued to make good on its promises to protect the free exercise and religious liberty of organizations and individuals within the United States. It moved yesterday to expand faith protections for federal contractors, the latest front in a battle between LGBTQ groups and employers seeking to operate in accordance with their religious principles. The proposed rule by the Labor Department Office of Federal Contract Compliance Program would make clear that, quote, religious organizations may make employment decisions consistent with their sincerely held religious tenets and beliefs without fear of sanction by the federal government, end quote. Joining me now with her analysis is Mary Beth Waddle, Family Research Council's Senior Legislative Assistant. Mary Beth, welcome back to Washington Watch.
Thanks, Sarah. Great to be here.
So let's talk a little bit about this proposed regulation. And it is indeed a proposed regulation because there is a commentary period open until September 16th. Is that correct?
Correct. It was just posted today, and so 30 days is the comment period.
So what does this proposed regulation make clear? What does it specify?
It basically makes clear that faith-based employers are on a level playing field with everyone else when it comes to their ability to contract with the government, that they don't have to check their faith at the door of their home or the door of their particular house of worship, that they can maintain their religious posture and still contract with the government.
And I like the notion that this is really in keeping with what the Trump administration has previously done. We know that there are numerous executive orders that Trump's administration has issued in specific reliance, both on constitutional protections and statutory protections, but also in light of some Supreme Court cases that have also made clear, listen, we won't tolerate overt hostility to free exercise. So can you give me a little bit of a sense of more of that history going into this particular proposal?
Yeah, they're doing that same thing here. They're looking at different Supreme Court cases, such as Trinity Lutheran, where a church, simply because they were a church, was initially denied the ability to take part in a program that allowed them to upgrade the playground that they housed. And it was simply because they were a church. And obviously the Supreme Court said no. The fact that they're a church does not prohibit them from being a grantee and from being able to be in these programs. And you have Title VII from the Civil Rights Act from back in 64 that has religious exceptions and allows for faith-based belief systems. And so they're bringing this in line with the Supreme Court and with the Civil Rights Act of 64.
So for these individuals to claim, and particularly based on the fact that the Obama administration was so sort of overtly hostile to a traditional interpretation of religious liberty's importance, and in fact, on his way out the door, issued executive orders including sexual orientation and gender identity within the interpretation of various federal protections. Trump seems to be really righting the ship and making clear that the text of the law, and now in combination with Supreme Court precedent, really ought to be interpreted precisely as it was written. And you have written an excellent piece, and I encourage our listeners to access it at frc.org/EqualityAct2019, because we know that is yet another attempt legislatively, though right now it's in the Senate and may not get any movement. It is another attempt to shoehorn these protections that were not originally designed for this category into a whole cloth modification of federal law. So really he's saying we have to do something now because we understand that the level of hostility is really only increasing.
Absolutely. And that's exactly what happened here with this executive order. There's an executive order going all the way back to President Johnson that's been amended, changed over time by other executive orders. And it was amended to narrow as much as possible the religious exception in the Obama administration. And so this is expanding that back to where it constitutionally and legally should be in line with the Supreme Court and with other statutes.
All right. So as we could have anticipated, the traditional cabal of left-wing organizations, the Human Rights Campaign, the ACLU, Center for American Progress, were up in arms about this. And in fact, the Washington Post headline led with essentially this title saying that it was an ongoing battle and that they were all up in arms over this. So let me read you a quote from Louise Melling, who is the ACLU deputy legal director and director of the Center for Liberty. This was a quote that she made just yesterday. "This is just the most recent in an ever-lengthening list of actions by this administration to authorize discrimination in the name of religion." Well, that's not a surprising categorization because really it's the entire fulcrum of the left-wing argument on this basis. When you hear language indicating that this is simply a license to discriminate, how do you respond as someone who studies this issue so closely?
If you read the actual rule itself, it explicitly says that it's intended to make clear that religious employers can condition employment on acceptance of and adherence of religious tenets, provided that they do not discriminate based on other protected bases. So they're making it clear that this is not a license to discriminate. It is the ability to not have to check your faith and your belief systems at the door, that they are open into the public square, and that is what freedom of religion is all about.
And I also like the fact that so much, and we know this, the statistics are overwhelming on it, so much charitable work is done by religious nonprofits that to put them in the position where they are federally punished, where they're subjected to lawsuits. We know that that entire segment, the portion of our populace that does the best work for these kids, for charities, for donations, for food banks, for orphanages, what you're doing is you're opening them up to discrimination themselves. If they are unable to contract with the federal government, those opportunities to provide services would really disappear. We don't want to do that as a society.
Absolutely. We've seen this play out within the adoption space. In a number of states and localities, Catholic Charities and others have been shut down, and their ability to contract, you know, with the government to be able to operate in the adoption and foster care space to help these children in need that they've been doing for centuries, long before the federal government ever got involved. And yet now they're being shut out. And we're seeing the harms that that is causing to these children who are left without a home.
Yes. And actually, to that extent, Alliance Defending Freedom, the same Christian law firm that represented Jack Phillips of Masterpiece Cake Shop out in Colorado, who unfortunately has been sued more than once for the same basis, simply by different organizations. The law firm, ADF, said that religious freedoms don't disappear when a university, charity, or international non-governmental organization enters into a contract with the federal government. That was Greg Baylor, who's their senior counsel. For example, he went on, eliminating faith-based nonprofits means that fewer foster children will find a forever home, fewer impoverished citizens will benefit from shelter and job training, and fewer people will receive compassionate assistance. It also leaves overtaxed communities without the vital services they provide. And in fact, the text of the proposed regulation, and for somebody who doesn't spend a lot of time looking at proposed regs, I went in and the support for this is substantial, pages and pages of why this is a regulation that is truly designed to enhance the common good, which is encouraging to see. Again, this is not a president who is saying, go ahead and discriminate, but indeed protecting what we consider to be our first freedom.
Absolutely. It's all about, and this is only within the Department of Labor. Like, this doesn't touch on HHS and these other organizations that would have a more direct effect on adoption. So hopefully this is just the first in a long line of, you know, these agencies being able to make these rules, because this is just one agency.
Yes. In fact, we had talked a little bit beforehand of some of the history going into this regulation. And in fact, this is just another piece of the entirety of the pie, the rebuilding, if you will, of the ability to practice, freely practice one's religious beliefs and to not have to disassociate with those beliefs. When you walk in an office, when you walk into a church, you may experience and practice those beliefs outside the walls of your church alone. And really, I think the way we're going, if we pay attention to what media is telling us, mainstream media, that everyone would be most comfortable on the left if we could just go to church on Sunday and we could leave them there and we couldn't exercise those beliefs or seek their ultimate protection in other contexts, whether they are state, federal, employment, or otherwise. So this is really encouraging to see, but it's kind of in keeping with the notion that this administration has followed from the outset, isn't it?
Absolutely. It's making sure the public square is open to all religion.
Mary Beth Waddle, who is Senior Legislative Assistant here at Family Research Council, has been my excellent guest. We are listening and talking about religious liberty, among other things. And we'll bring it up again in our next segment with Dr. Michelle Critella, President of the American College of Pediatricians. When a USA Today op-ed was published about a father desperate for help with his child on the spectrum. We'll talk with her when we get back on Washington Watch.
In states like New York, Virginia, and Vermont, radical legislation has been written legalizing abortion late in pregnancy, when babies can feel pain and are able to live outside the womb.
Happy birthday to you.
They've gone even further, repealing protections of infants born alive, allowing killing even after birth.
Happy
Congress has yet to protect the life of every newborn baby. Visit endbirthdayabortion.com to send Nancy Pelosi a newborn hat to show Congress every new life should be welcomed with warmth and love, not hate, not death. End birthday abortions. Visit endbirthdayabortion.com.
Happy birthday to you.
Paid for by Family Research Council.
Are you concerned with the state of our nation? Do you want to protect and promote religious freedom, the sanctity of life, free speech, and our children's educations? Today we see a growing threat against our values on the news, on our college campuses, in our elementary schools, at our public libraries, and in our courts. Every year in Washington, D.C., thousands of conservatives attend FRC Action's Values Voters Summit. From October 11th to the 13th, come to our nation's capital to mingle with and hear from key conservatives who are bringing real change to Washington, D.C., and learn how you can too. FRC President Tony Perkins will be there, along with Ali Stuckey, Bill Bennett, Dana Lash, Oliver North, and U.S. House and Senate leaders. The 2020 elections are right around the corner, so this is one weekend you won't want to miss. We provide free scholarships for students. Register online at valuesvotersummit.org or call 1-877-372-2808. That's 1-877-372-2808.
Are you looking for timely and honest coverage of the latest news? Do you find it difficult to sort out what is true and what is false from the media? Family Research Council is here to help. FRC President Tony Perkins' daily Washington Update email newsletter addresses the most important current events affecting religious freedom, the protection of life, marriage and family, and more, not only in Washington, but around the world. The Washington Update's daily articles cover a range of topics, from underreported stories about transgender activists' efforts to infiltrate our schools to updates on court cases fighting for religious freedom, parental rights, and the protection of life. Don't miss this critical, in-depth analysis of the day's most essential stories that are shaping our nation's future. Learn more and subscribe by visiting frc.org/update. Again, that's frc.org/update.
Welcome back to Washington Watch. I am Sarah Perry, Director of Partnerships here at FRC. I am filling in for Tony Perkins on this Thursday. On Monday of this week, USA Today published a heartbreaking column by a dad entitled, "My Daughter Thinks She's Transgender. Her Public School Undermined My Efforts to Help Her." Author of the op-ed is Jay Keck, who lives in a suburb outside Chicago. With his child, he is a member of the Kelsey Coalition, which promotes policies to protect young people from what the group considers to be the medical and psychological harms of transgender medicine. He's also the Chicago leader of Parents of Rapid Onset Gender Dysphoria Kids, a support group. But unfortunately, the government school system is now pushing the transgender narrative so hard that officials perceive the parents to be the enemies of the state unless they sign off on hormone blockers and mutilations for their children, including life-altering surgeries. Joining me with her analysis is Dr. Michelle Critella, president of the American College of Pediatricians, one of the few physicians I know willing to speak truth into a surprisingly controversial field. Dr. Critella, welcome back to Washington Watch.
Hi, Sarah. Thanks for having me on. It's good to be here.
So in April of 2016, Jay writes that his then 14-year-old daughter became convinced that she was a boy. And he writes this: "Throughout my daughter's childhood, there were no signs that she wanted to be a boy. She loved stuffed animals, Pocahontas, wearing colorful bathing suits. I can't recall a single interest that seemed unusually masculine or any evidence she was uncomfortable." Now, this proves factually critical because, as it turns out, Jay's daughter had difficulty forming and maintaining friendships, and he learned later she was on the autism spectrum. Give us some insight here. How does being on the autism spectrum possibly lead to someone thinking that they might want to be the opposite gender?
Well, what we know about autism and gender dysphoria or discomfort with your gender is that there's a sevenfold increase representation among children with autism, and children on the autism spectrum have, as this father writes, all of them have difficulty with social interactions and mm-hmm. social cues. they are more prone to depression and anxiety. They also have a tendency to fixate and latch on to particular ideas or topics. And what we see with the transgender movement, which is flourishing throughout the social media, public schools, Hollywood, it's capturing the attention of the entire adolescent population, and in particular, when we have adolescents who are autistic or those who are otherwise depressed or anxious, this transgender identity is being held out as the answer to their angst.
Mm-hmm.
So they latch on to this as anyone would, as a solution. This is the answer. This is why I'm not making friends. This is why I don't feel right. You know, it's not that they feel like the opposite sex. How can anyone know what it is to feel like the opposite sex? It's that
right.
You feel like an outsider. You feel sad. You feel every adolescent goes through some angst, and those on the autism spectrum are at a higher risk.
And I can say, speaking from experience here, and I think you and I have sort of corresponded about this in different formats, my oldest has Asperger's syndrome, the precursor to what's now referred to as autism spectrum disorder. He is now 15, so boy, oh boy, did it hit a nerve with me. And I can tell you that they have a tendency to perseverate on things, and there is a disconnectedness. It must have felt very much to this young lady, who the dad has already said has difficulty making friends, that this was the key to what was going on. And in fact, the timeline on this was that in high school, his daughter was approached by a girl who had recently come out at school as transgender. And shortly after meeting her, the talk began that his own daughter was transgender as well. But the real tragedy, as you know from reading the article, is that the school officials kept Jay and his wife in the dark. Unbeknownst to them, the teachers and school administrators referred to their daughter by a new masculine name, treated her as if she were a boy, used male pronouns, and gave her access to a gender-neutral restroom. So I'm afraid to ask, but is this atypical for a school to hide this?
No. Unfortunately, since the Obama administration came out with the Dear Colleague letter in 2016, although it was not legally binding, at that time, Obama urged public schools to treat gender identity as an innate and immutable trait like sex, and implied that they could risk losing federal funding if they did not do so. Now, it was not legally binding. In fact, I believe it was even struck down and blocked by a judge within a few months of it being pronounced. And more importantly, the Trump administration outright rescinded it. So despite that, however, the vast majority of school districts in America still basically establish policies that treat gender identity as sex, and all school staff are told that they must not reveal a child's gender identity to a parent unless the child allows it.
Mm. Dr. Michelle Curtella, the American College of Pediatricians, an excellent physician, but also a physician willing to speak a very difficult, increasingly difficult truth, as this father, Jay Keck, did in Chicago. You're listening to Washington Watch. I am Sarah Perry, sitting in for Tony Perkins. Coming up next, Lieutenant General Jerry Boykin, Family Research Council's vice president, talks to me about the 7th anniversary of a shooting a few floors down from where I sit now. We'll be right back.
Did you know that Planned Parenthood was using taxpayer dollars to perform abortions? Recently, the Trump administration made changes to a healthcare policy called Title 10. The changes to this policy now eliminate the loopholes organizations like Planned Parenthood were using to receive taxpayer funding for abortions. Planned Parenthood was hiding behind terms like reproductive health care and services like cancer screenings and contraception distribution, while in reality, they were making money off of abortions. This shift in funding will benefit community health centers that provide needy families with family planning resources and health services, regardless of their ability to pay. It will also benefit pregnancy resource centers that provide care and free resources to women who may be experiencing an unplanned pregnancy. This policy decision is the right move to help and protect American lives. To learn more, visit frc.org/Title 10. That's frc.org/Title 10.
Hi, my name is Bailey. I am serving as an intern at Family Research Council, and it has been a life-changing experience. Interns join FRC's team of experts as they embark upon the mission of advancing faith, family, and freedom in public policy and the culture from a biblical worldview. The FRC internship is a 12 to 15 week program designed to educate and inspire university students who are passionate about public service and who believe that a biblical worldview is fundamental to the reformation of government and culture. As interns, we receive the opportunity to work alongside and be personally and professionally developed by FRC's team of experts. This paid internship offers free housing in the heart of DC, which allows us to be fully immersed in the fast-paced political climate and to build a community with other faithful conservatives in our nation's capital. For more information and to apply, visit frc.org/internships. That's frc.org/internships.
Welcome back to Washington Watch on this Thursday edition. I am Sarah Perry. I am sitting in for Tony Perkins today. An armed intruder spouting opposition to social conservatism walked into our headquarters here in Washington, D.C. 7 years ago today and shot Leo Johnson, our building manager, before Leo wrestled him to the floor, sustaining a gunshot wound until police arrived. They identified the shooter as Floyd Lee Corkins II, 28, of Herndon, Virginia. He had a master's degree from George Mason University and was a gay activist who said, "I got this organization's name off the Southern Poverty Law Center's hate list." Joining me now is Lieutenant General Jerry Boykin, our executive vice president, a founding member of the elite Delta Force, who was here that day, as were 17 other FRC employees. General Boykin, welcome back to Washington Watch.
Hey, thank you, Sarah. I'm glad to be with you.
What was your memory of that violent encounter in our lobby 7 years ago today, where the bullet holes are still in the wall?
Yeah, you know, Sarah, first of all, as an old soldier, you know, you kind of run to the guns. So there's something that kind of wells up in you when you hear gunshots. But I was not prepared for what I saw there in the lobby. Leo was bleeding quite profusely from his left arm from a 9mm round that went through his left arm. And the pistol was laying on the floor there, Corkins was laying face down, and you know what went through my mind as an old soldier is grab the pistol and finish this guy, you know. But what was miraculous about it, Sarah, was the police were literally having coffee right next door. Two police on bicycles, and they were in the door there in just a flash. And from that point on, you know, it became a matter of taking care of Leo. But I couldn't understand, what is this guy doing in here? I mean, why us? And until he explained it to the FBI during the questioning and then later to the judge. He was there to kill us because the Southern Poverty Law Center said we were a hate group because we stood for traditional biblical marriage.
Now, you and I understand the Southern Poverty Law Center. We understand their MO, but I want to talk to the listeners a little bit about why an organization like FRC is on the same type of list as the KKK, the neo-Nazis and the racist skinheads. Where is the motivation from the Southern Poverty Law Center on this kind of a list?
Well, the Southern Poverty Law Center, first of all, let me say this. I in my opinion, they're one of the most evil organizations in America. And that has been borne out, I think, in the latest publicity they've gotten about being a sexist, racist organization. But that said, what we have known for a long time is that they are really an arm of the left. In fact, I would say to you, they are an arm of the ultra-left. They're shills for the progressive movement. And anybody that does not agree with them politically is subject to being placed on that hate list. And the legitimacy of that hate list is zero. There's no legitimacy. And even now, one of their own has acknowledged that there really is no legitimacy to it. But what does it do? It helps them raise money. And the one thing that we can say about them, with $500 million in their coffers, is they are a money-making machine, and they have targeted conservative groups, especially if you are a Christian conservative group. You might as well expect that if you're having any impact at all, they're going to put you on that list.
Have there been any modifications to this list over time? One would think that the SPLC would have a very, very compelling reason to apologize to FRC and to take our organization off. Has anything like that happened?
No, they've never said anything to us. They've never communicated with us in any way after that shooting with regards to the shooting. But have there been modifications? Yeah, they took Ben Carson off after they called him a hater. and they took off Nawaz, I forget his name. You know it better than I do.
Yeah, Majid Nawaz. Yep.
Majid Nawaz, they took him off after they wound up having to pay him $3.75 million to settle a lawsuit out of court for defamation of character. And so, yeah, there's been modifications. But for the most part, the only modifications are they've added people and organizations to that. Because as conservative groups start really influencing people's way of thinking, you can bet you're going to be on that hate list. They'll find a reason to list you with the Ku Klux Klan and all of the other very extremist organizations in America. But what's not on that list is Antifa. Mm-hmm. What's not on that list is any of those groups like Antifa that has called for the killing of police. They're not on the list, but that's because they're part of the same progressive movement, leftist front that the Southern Poverty Law Center is.
Well, as we approach another weekend where we have heard rumblings of the Antifa operatives and the Portland Proud Boys getting ready to face off again, I am reminded of God's providence in our organization and his ultimate continued protection over these employees at this organization and over those who call upon his name. Welcome to this next segment of Washington Watch, in which we are going to talk about an absence of common sense, but a prevalence of left-wing rhetoric with Penny Nance of Concerned Women for America. We'll be right back on Washington Watch.
We live in a time of great political division, and this division only intensifies during campaign season. The toxic tone in politics can be discouraging, which makes it a very real temptation for many Christians to wipe their hands of politics altogether. After all, if God is sovereign and controls the heart of the king, as Proverbs says, do we really need to get involved in the messy world of politics? Because political engagement can be divisive, shouldn't Christians abandon politics and direct their energies toward more spiritual pursuits? Christians are called to submit every area of their life to God, which includes how they engage in politics. But they are called to engage biblically. This requires Christians to be prepared to follow their political theology to its logical end and vote for candidates and parties that support clear biblical values. For more information on the Christians' call to engage in politics, visit frc.org/engage. That's frc.org/engage.
Radical abortion laws in New York, Illinois, and Vermont are challenging the sanctity of life. These laws have lifted the few existing restrictions on abortion in the name of family planning and mental health of pregnant mothers. Americans need to take a stand and defend the rights of the unborn. Family Research Council is sending Congress 90,000 baby hats as a reminder that babies should be welcomed with love and warmth, not potential danger. Supporters have already funded over 45,000 hats. We are over halfway there. Join Americans across the nation and donate $9 to send a powerful reminder that young lives need to be cherished. When you take action, we'll send you an end birthday abortion certificate that will remind you to pray for born alive babies who are facing the danger of being killed outside the womb. Visit endbirthdayabortion.com for more information. That's endbirthdayabortion.com.
Hello, this is Tony Perkins, President of the Family Research Council here in Washington, D.C., and I would like to invite you to join my wife, Luana, and I, along with Lieutenant General Jerry Boykin and former Congresswoman Michelle Bachmann, for FRC's Israel Tour, June the 2nd through the 12th, 2020. Whether you're sailing on the Sea of Galilee, standing in the ruins of Capernaum, or journeying up to Jerusalem, Israel is unlike any other place on earth. You'll relive the final earthly days of Jesus as you pray in the Garden of Gethsemane. You look upon Golgotha and stand in the garden tomb. The reality of his story will come alive in a transformative way. This one-of-a-kind tour will not only allow you to explore the land of the Bible and the roots of our Christian faith, you'll also hear firsthand from some of Israel's political, defense, and religious leaders. Join us June the 2nd through June the 12th for this life-changing experience. For more information, visit TonyPerkins.com or call 844-872-5155.
Welcome back to Washington Watch. I am Sarah Perry. I am sitting in for Tony Perkins on this Thursday. As a reminder, TonyPerkins.com is our podcast website. Follow Tony on Twitter at TPerkins or me if you'd like. At Sarah P. Perry. We are going to be talking about intersectionality and campus mayhem. We are at peak tyranny and lunacy on American higher education campuses. And as the mother of three, I shudder as we approach the college phase with my oldest, who is in high school, because there are some of us who are starting to feel like exiles among academia. Those of us who work hard and pay taxes and want to send our children to esteemed universities and colleges. And one of those colleges is Virginia Tech, home of the Hokies and, though a competitor to my own alma mater of University of Virginia, I have known some very fine people who graduated from Virginia Tech. And today I am joined by a very special guest who understands full well what, in practice, the left's tyranny looks like on college campuses. Penny Nance is the president of Concerned Women for America, and she recently wrote a piece in The Federalist entitled, "My Son's Freshman Orientation at Virginia Tech Was Full of Leftist Propaganda." Penny, so glad to have you on Washington Watch.
Thank you, Sarah. Thank you for inviting me on.
So I'm very, very anxious to talk to you about this because it is something that I am all too afraid I am getting ready to face myself. Now, in light of the fact that Virginia Tech is a school focused on hard sciences and your son plans to study engineering, were you surprised that your son got an earful of this mushy leftist propaganda when you walked in the front door at orientation?
I thought I was prepared. My daughter went to Liberty University. I certainly didn't expect Virginia Tech to be at all similar to Liberty University, a Christian institution. But I didn't expect what I got. And orientation, I mean, really, there's so much in the piece in The Federalist. I would just urge your listeners to go read it and to also follow me on Twitter, PY Nance. And I put it out there, but the details are in the article. But the bottom line is this whole gender identity politics has taken over academia. A very small group of people have been able to really sort of take over the message. So I didn't realize it at the time, but my son, along with all the other students there, were either forced a course because I wasn't sitting by him when he was doing the click through, although I've seen some screen images since. It doesn't appear that there was an easy way to go around it. But they were coerced, let's say, into giving their preferred pronouns. Let me back up and say my son does not struggle with that. But let's say you're a kid who does. Let's say a kid that is struggling with gender dysphoria. What the school has essentially done has coerced him or her into making a decision right that minute. In order to attend and have a badge for orientation, you need to tell them what your preferred pronoun is and then hang it around your neck and be mm-hmm. labeled. And so that, to me, was the worst part of it. But every single person that addressed us in the orientation, quote-unquote, welcome session, started out with their name and which gender, whatever their preferred pronouns were going to be. And by the way, there were no plot twists. Everybody was just exactly as you would expect. So it was pretty
so sort of pointless, right? Defeats the point of using your special pronoun anyway.
Right. We would have guessed that. No shocker. The parents sitting there at the front, because my husband couldn't come, I was alone. They separated the parents from the kids in the auditorium. I started watching the parents around me, and at first, they're a little surprised at the first. About the 10th person who did it, they're starting to get upset. It's so heavy-handed. They're rolling their eyes. Some of them are leaving, and when we walk out, I'm just listening. They're like, I cannot believe that just happened. That's ridiculous. Boy, that was pointless. The whole thing could have been cut down by an hour if they hadn't bothered to have everyone tell us what their pronoun was. I mean, they were just annoyed by the entire thing. But it was sort of set the tone for the day. I asked to speak with the president of the university to try to explain to him why what they did was unwelcoming and offensive to kids, not just Christian kids, but kids of many faiths, why parents found it disturbing, why the tone was wrong. Let me back up and say the very beginning of the day, I didn't expect there to be the Pledge of Allegiance. I didn't expect there to be opening of prayer. But let's remember that Virginia Tech is a military college with the names of the cadets who have died inscribed in a memorial, everyone since World War I. And it was the scene of the most deadly shooting on a school shooting in U.S. history in 2007. So I would have thought maybe at the beginning there would have been a moment of silence to recognize one or both of those groups. But no. You know what we did, Sarah? We took a second to recognize the Indian tribes on whose land we stood. I mean, it was propaganda from the get-go. And so conservative parents were just left shaking their heads, wondering, what have we done? What have we done that the hard science school, the more conservative school, the math and science, the engineering school of our state has swung so far to the left that they think this is the idea, this is what we should roll out to the parents and the students on the first day?
It sounds so much like heavy-handed pandering. It really does. And in an effort, I can't imagine, other than anything else, but to avoid whatever the perceived danger is, the perceived mythical lawsuit from the transgender community, which seems to be apparently driving out the existence of common sense in academia, in politics, in medicine, in schools, and elsewhere. It seems so terribly heavy-handed and so obviously an attempt to pander that it makes one wonder if these administrators were fearful that someone from Human Rights Campaign was sitting in the audience under the guise of secrecy and that they were going to get slapped with some kind of a suit. Because for me, this kind of a welcome simply on the first day of orientation and structured the way it was structured indicates to me these officials knew exactly what they were doing, didn't they?
Well, I think they did. And I, and again, I've tried to reach out and have a conversation with someone of some authority. I've been offered lower level staff, and I'm like, well, hang on. I represent the nation's largest public policy women's organization. And I'm a parent, and I very much would like to talk with someone who has some authority in the situation. By the way, the president of Virginia Tech, Tim Sands, is a graduate of Berkeley. He's been there since 2014 from San Francisco. I think, you know, he has different sensibilities, I think, than the people of Virginia. But this is, you know, a conversation that will continue. We will be having it among parents groups. We'll be having it with the Virginia legislature, which controls most of the money that's appropriated to the university. And the responses I've got have been so they just don't get it, you know. And, by the way, as a result of my daring to speak out, my son's been doxxed. He's been threatened. And I've been told, by the way, they've called me a racist because how dare I call out, you know, this situation that I don't think is appropriate.
Right.
No tolerance certainly there. And I've been told I need to go to take my son to Liberty. I'm not welcome. This is by other students and people that are involved with the university. And so I just think, as much as I am uncomfortable with this situation and where I am, it just keeps dawning on me that if I can't have this conversation, if I, as the head of the nation's largest women's organization with a platform, with a, you know, thousands of women who support what we do, with an entire staff, with legal resources at my fingertips, no one can. No one can say anything because the parents are sitting there afraid their kid's going to be bullied. I've heard from employees of the university who are very upset about the direction of the university. They're afraid of getting fired. The students are afraid of getting singled out and their grade being lowered. If we don't stand up and speak for them, no one will, and we might as well just become educational refugees to Christian schools because that's our only other option, and that's what they want.
Of course, and that's an unfortunate, anticipated outcome of the left for what, if they continue their current course of action, will transpire for those of us on the right. I, for one, and I know you as well, and I have known plenty of other wonderful parents. Previously, we had on Dr. Michelle Cretella. She is also one of them. I refuse to participate in the legal fiction of another individual because I am simply afraid of a rhetoric storm. My philosophy on this, and I know it is yours as well, my heart aches and breaks for individuals who are experiencing gender dysphoria, knowing what I know, particularly about its prevalence in the autism community, and having just talked to Dr. Cretella about this exact same thing. This could have been an effect in my own life. However, to force that belief on another individual and to attempt to drive out any dissent comes across to me, I have to tell you, as cultish, to refuse an alternate for discussion and to take beyond any opportunity to believe Muslims, Christians, Orthodox Jews, any individual in that audience during parent orientation, to believe, to refuse that there is dissent, you've entirely alienated a large portion of your listening audience by forcing them to participate in this legal fiction. And it actually gets worse because you write that after the parents were sent off to bed, school administrators lectured students on not making assumptions about each other's gender or sexuality. So your head must have exploded the next day.
Well, by that time, nothing could shock me.
Right.
Orientation. You know, there's one thing at one point I think I need to make, and I think this is something the school really should try to take a moment to recognize. I don't believe they're giving their students enough credit. I honestly believe, because there is a small percentage of kids that are struggling. We've acknowledged that, and it's real, and our hearts do break for them. I honestly believe the students are kind and sensitive enough to work it out between them. They don't need speech codes coming down from the heavy hand of the university. They don't need
yes.
it. I think we have raised our children to be loving and kind and to be respectful of each other. I think they can figure it out and figure out how to navigate that without being forced into a corner into saying words that they don't believe, that hurt their conscience, that is in direct violation of their religious beliefs. And what the school does not care about is that, you just pointed out, there are large factions of religious groups who stand in direct contradiction to that way of thinking. And we've got biology majors at the school.
Right.
They're studying science that are secularists that disagree. So everybody has to get in line, is what we're basically being told. Get in line. This is the party line. This is the speech code. Get ready for it. And anyone who dares to dissent is an apostate and
right.
will suffer the bullying and the things that I'm experiencing in these last couple of days. So we either have to, one, just back down and everybody just go into our corners and become, as I said, educational refugees only to Christian schools, which I love Liberty. I think that's great. It's a great school. I got a great education, and I'd highly recommend it. Or for our kids, especially ones that are math and science kids that have very specialty topics of education that they need to study in schools that meet that need specifically, the parents need to fight the battle. They need to call the president and the administration of the university, call them on the carpet, call their state legislators, and get involved. Link arms together. We're stronger together. They can't destroy all of us. They can't, you know, if we really come together, we have strength in numbers. And so, you know, I guess as painful as it is, and believe me, I'm scared. Like, this is scary. I don't want to do this. But I'm not going to pretend, and I can't unsee what I've seen. And if I can't speak, as I said earlier, Sarah, if I can't address it, then literally nobody can. And I just refuse to not take the responsibility for all these women who are our members in Virginia and around the country who are suffering in silence and need somebody that's willing to tell the truth. And so I'm doing it, and I, you know, I'm prayerfully praying for, and I would love it to have the prayers of your audience for safety and for encouragement for my son and our family as we go down this road.
Penny, we will be praying for you here at FRC. We will ask our listeners to do the same. Penny Nance, president of Concerned Women for America, has been my guest today. Send screenshots, video, or your story about this type of speech and indoctrination to Concerned Women for America at universitywhistleblower@cwfa.org. You have been listening to Washington Watch. I have been Sarah Perry, sitting in for Tony Perkins on this Thursday edition. The University VP for Student Affairs, use of gender-neutral pronouns are common, but we ask, are they correct? We'll talk to you tomorrow on Washington Watch.
Washington Watch with Tony Perkins is powered by the Family Research Council and is entirely listener-supported. For more information on anything you've heard today, or to find out how you can partner with us in our ongoing efforts to promote faith, family, and freedom, visit TonyPerkins.com. Also, to leave a comment about Washington Watch, call our watch line at 1-866-372-7234. That's 1-866-372-7234.